Today is Friday, April 7th, 2023. This is part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charlie Schulz. Charlie spells his last name S-C-H-U-L-Z, and my name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Charlie. How are you today?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Great. Charlie, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You do have my permission.
Thank you. Charlie, we left off last time with a rim-to-rim in October of 1987. Can you pick that thread up?
Okay. I'd like to go back to 1982 and kind of cover the background and how this started.
Okay.
In my past up to about 1978, I'd been in the Air Force, and you're required to run a mile and a half in 12 minutes. So I did that, but I never enjoyed it. And then the 1978-1979, I started working in Phoenix, and one of my office mates was a fellow by the name of Brian Keyes, and he came from New York State. He had worked there, and he had transferred out to go to work at the startup company that the startup of this company in the Phoenix area. And he was into running and cycling and stuff, and he eventually convinced me I should try it. So I started running a little bit, some 5Ks, then 10Ks, and then started riding my bike to and from work. And then eventually we got to half marathons and even ran a marathon. And in 1982, Brian mentioned to me that he had seen this ad in one of the local running, they were kind of like newspapers, and it mentioned a rim-to-rim run in October of 1982, and he convinced me, although I knew it wasn't going to be easy, he convinced me at that time that, you know, we should do this rim-to-rim run, and it was sponsored by the Advantage Pro Shop here in Phoenix. And they actually had two commercial buses, and I don't remember exactly the number, but probably between 200 and 300 people. And they transported us all to the North Rim. And then this was on, let me look here real quick, October 3rd of 1982.
Okay.
And everybody was dumped out on the North Rim at the top of the North Kaibab Trail, and down across the river and come up to South Kaibab. And they had recruited people who worked in the restaurants and the hotels on the South Rim to actually carry water down to the Esplanade and to, not the Esplanade, the plateau right after you come up from the river on the South Kaibab.
On the Tonto there.
Yes, the Tonto right. Plateau. And again, then when you got to the top, of a series of switchbacks here, and then kind of shoot back along the ridge line where the bathroom is now and where they tie up the mules on the way up or down.
Yeah, Cedar Ridge.
Yes, and there was water there. And then they had a banner at the top of the trail, across the top. They had people to take our times and all that kind of stuff. And that was the first time I had done a rim-to-rim. And that was the 20-mile, 20.4, something like that. And Brian, I passed him part of the way up, and he said he didn't think he was going to make it, just let people know where his body was. But he did make it out. And there was one other fellow that was with us that was also worked with us, but I cannot remember his name for some reason, and even though he showed up in a couple of photos and so on. But I did have some pictures from that and from the trailhead, and we all got a shirt, and then they hauled us back to Phoenix and Tucson. The total bus is made up of people from those two areas, Phoenix and Tucson.
Okay.
And Alan Cureton did run that year. That was the year before the same group had sponsored the run in 1981. He set a Canyon best known time at that time, about 3 hours and 15 minutes. And he did it right around that same time, 3 hours and 20 minutes or so on, this time as well. So he at that time still held the best known time for a rim-to-rim at that point in time.
Okay.
And that information I passed on to Kim, is it Beesom?
Beesom.
Beesom? Okay.
Yeah.
So I sent that off yesterday, so she should have that in a couple of days.
Great. And you covered all of that. We did that in one of our histories, one of our oral histories.
Pardon?
We covered that in one of our oral histories.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe the next part, it was 1985 when I was running with some friends along one of the canals in the Phoenix area.
Right. You mentioned that, too.
I did.
Yeah.
Okay. And how we started then the next series of canyon runs.
Right. That's right.
Okay. Okay, so that was 1985 was the first one, and I somehow volunteered to organize it, and we ended up with about 8 or 10 of us, and we started that. And then it went on to becoming an annual thing, and we did it again in 86 and then in 1987.
Right, and we covered 86, but we haven't covered 87, right.
Okay, and 87, it was October, somewhere... right around October 1st, and I don't have that exact date for some reason. But again, it's right at the beginning. And this is the first time, up to this time, the people that ran it were pretty much people that worked or were affiliated with a company that I worked with, worked for in North Phoenix. And it was actually a nationwide company that had affiliates. It was called GTE, and they had affiliates all over the country and so on, and the word got out. So we got from initially 8 or 9 people, mostly people ran with, to getting up into the 20s at that point in time. And in 1987, we had a pretty good busload, and we had a driver that, then at that time, before, we'd been using people that we knew to drive the van around, but this time we had a bus, and so the bus drivers were professional drivers and took up the challenge to driving around and beating the first runner out.
Okay.
So those had to be some harrowing bus rides because they were doing it in like 4.5 hours from the North Rim.
Wow, yeah, that's a fast. Well, the bus is empty. It's strong and powerful, and so they could step on it.
Yeah. And so that one, C.L. Johnson, who was the guy that I had been doing most of my backpacking in the Grand Canyon with, up until that time, although he did run some, he didn't run very far, and he said the longest he'd ever done had been like 12 miles, and he said it bothered his knees and everything else. Well, he finally was interested enough and intrigued enough that he ran with us that year.
Oh, wow.
And at 55 years old, he was finishing in 5 hours and 35 minutes.
Wow.
Yep. He decided he could run it. And he ran then for every year after that.
That's great.
He actually got down to real close to 5 hours at one point.
Wow.
So that was 1987. And 1988, we did another one.
Well, wait. Before we go to 88, now let's take these 1 year at a time.
Okay.
And what I've got down here from talking with you last time we talked, this was October 10th. Does that sound right?
Well, it sounds late, and that's why
You mentioned that there was something else you did October 1st, down the North Kaibab, backpack, and then out the Bright Angel.
Yeah, I think that should have been down the South Kaibab.
Oh, okay.
And then up the Bright Angel, and that was a training run, if you'll take it as that.
Okay.
We would, once in a while, we would go up to the canyon, and we would, out by where the kennels are.
Yes.
We could drive in the back way, back.
Yep.
At that time,
yep. Come in that way.
Red Feather Lodge, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we'd drive back in that way, and we would camp, and then we'd get up in the night, or in the morning, and drive and park by the trail, the Bright Angel trailhead.
Right.
We take the mule trail from the Bright Angel over to the South Kaibab, down the South Kaibab to the river, and then back up again.
Oh, wow. And so you make a loop out of that.
We'd make a loop out of it, yeah.
Wow.
But that gave us some of the down and up. If you don't do some downs and ups, you don't have the right training for that kind of an activity.
Right.
We also, in Phoenix, would go to the top of South Mountain and run down to the bottom of South Mountain and then turn around and run back up.
Okay.
Because it wasn't anywhere near the distance, but it was some of the same beating you take when you're running down the trail and coming back up. So
yeah.
That was kind of our training regimen, to find someplace where we could start up high, and you could drive to the top of South Mountain down to Tucson where the big radio towers and everything are.
Okay.
And there are trails up there you can pick up, and we could take those all the way down, make a loop out of it, and then come back up.
Okay. And this run in 1987, were you the organizer?
I organized all of them except the one in 1996. And
okay. So where do you get a big bus? I mean, who are you, Greyhound? Who do you call?
Well, there are bus services, and, you know, especially in the Phoenix area, because of during the tourist season, people come in with companies, and they bring in all their marketers or whatever, and they bus them out to golf courses there. They bus them out for Jeep rides, or they bus them here or there. So there are companies in the Phoenix area that you can rent a bus and a driver.
Okay.
And that's what we did. And the first 2 years, we used a 15 or 16 passenger van. And that one we just rented, and I drove up and back. And then we had a friend or an acquaintance of a friend that drove from the north rim around to the south rim. And, of course, didn't run. And then the next year we had another person that wanted to check it out and wanted to know what was going on and whether to run or not. And he drove around that year.
Okay.
And then after that, we went to it was like a 24-passenger bus.
Mm, okay.
And a professional driver. And
now, Charlie, this is costing somebody some money here. I mean, let's just get this bus as a volunteer. How did you swing it financially?
Well, there was three parts to the cost. There was the cost for the bus, the cost for the rooms on the north and south side, because we spent the north side and then on the south. And then we started doing T-shirts amongst ourselves for each one. So I think originally I charged everybody like $100.50, and we actually got up to over $200. And again, this is 1987, so the prices today, looking at that, would look a little different. I do have a couple of places where I did accounting and printed it out and sent it back to everybody so they knew that I wasn't
taking
money and running off to Canada or anything.
Because the rooms, I mean, just clearly you got, you know, multiple people staying in a room, but we're starting to talk real money real fast here chartering a bus, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think the rooms at that time were like either $75 or $80. And we stayed in the little frontier cabins on the North Rim and back in the woods over by one of the cafeterias and one of those low-slung, slump-box motel-like buildings back
not,
in there.
Not the Thunderbird, but maybe the Maswick or the
the one that's over by the grocery store.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Back in behind there was some one-story kind of motel-like little rooms.
You bet.
Yeah, and we stayed back in there. So I think those cost us like $80 a night. So that's $180. So two guys, that was $80. And the bus cost us, I don't remember, but with 10 people, maybe the van was cheap, of course. All we had to do was pay for the van and the thing. But when we went to the 24-passenger bus, we were at about 20 people then.
Okay.
And people had to sign up fairly early, too, because I had to make the reservations. And even then, it was hard to get, you know, 10 rooms on each side.
Ah.
You know, as part of it. And that's what kind of led to our downfall, ultimately. And I'm not sure how that came about, but in any case...
At that size, you're talking about 20 people. That's one bus. There's 10 rooms each side. Now, this is, you know, things are kind of winding down in October. Right. And it's not kind of closing weekend. I guess it sounds like you were maybe the weekend before, so your chances of getting the rooms were okay. But I'm wondering, did you have more people apply than you had ability to take?
Well,
and did you have a waiting list? I mean, how did you do that?
Well, it did grow, and by 1994, I think, was the biggest year. I had over 30 people, and then we were in a bus with a bathroom, one of those big buses.
Oh, wow.
And I was charging them, I think, 200 or 2 1/4 each. So,
okay.
And we a bus with a driver, we have to have a room for the driver as well. So,
right, yep, yep.
So all that kind of stuff was adding up. I never lost money, but
okay.
I shouldn't say that. Maybe a couple times it cost me maybe a couple $100 more than I thought I was going to. But
okay.
Overall, I never really lost any serious money in that. The biggest thing I was concerned about was liability. And I'm not a lawyer, although I worked with lawyers quite a bit during my career.
Uh-huh.
And so as people were added on, I always had kind of a serious vetting process with, look at, this is what this is. You go down that trail, you're on your own. If something happens to you, you got to get yourself out. You need help, you call the Rangers and get your, whatever. And really tried to convince people that this was not a supported, quote, run, and nobody's doing anything except you're sharing the cost of getting up there and getting back, and the rest of it's on you, as to what you do when you get there.
I see.
And I tried to make that really clear with people as they kind of came on and brought other people. And a lot of times, or not a lot of times, several times they were like a brother, somebody said, well, my brother really likes to go along. Well, can you vouch for your brother,
Right.
Is he up for this and that kind of stuff? And then we had one guy whose name was Dick Lane, and he had worked for GTE, and he was, at that time, he was in his early 60s, probably 60 or 61, and he was an ultra runner. He ran things like Western States 100 and the Leadville 100 and stuff like that. Not always successfully, but he trained to run that kind of stuff. And he, because he worked for GT, somehow he found out about this. In the second year, he joined us. And then he brought a couple people along at different times. In fact, he brought the only woman who ever ran with us. Her name was Jennifer Henderson, and she kicked everybody's butt that year. So,
what year was that?
That was 91 or 92.
Okay, so that's coming up. So we're still in 87. Okay, all right. Was Dick in 87? Was he on the 87 run?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Dick was there. In fact, he and Terry Moore used to go back and forth as far as who was going to win. And,
okay.
And year. Dick was a really good, strong ultra runner. And so, although this was, even to him, a challenge, he still was one of the tougher runners of the group. He also helped us get into another run, which is the Dipsy, which takes place in California on the north of the Golden Gate Bridge. You go across the peninsula from the...
What's it called? What's the name of the run?
It's called the Dipsy.
D-I-P-S-E-Y?
E-A. Dipsy. The idea was to run, dip your foot in the bay, and then run across and dip your foot in the sea.
Oh, dip sea. Wow, okay.
Yeah. And it's an old race. It's been on since 1900 or 1905.
Oh, wow.
Something like that. And it's an interesting race because it's they've collected data over the years as to the age and time of people finishing, and then you're handicapped so that the slowest people start first and the fastest people start last.
Huh.
The idea being, see how many people we can get to the other side at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Well, of course, the young people are all motivated to run like crazy. But at the end, when they had the award ceremony, they gave out 40 T-shirts for the first 40 people. And it was really interesting to, at the award ceremony, because you might have number one was a 35-year-old woman, and number two was a 17-year-old kid, and number three was a 10-year-old girl, and number four was a 45-year-old man. And
wow.
It was such a mix of people because of the handicap.
Huh.
You know, so if you could be a good runner in your age group, you have a good chance of placing well. And to get one of those 40 shirts is even to this day, as far as I know, is still highly coveted. And it was a race that you only got into. They had two groups. They had people who had run it before below a certain time, and they were, if they applied, they got in. Then they had another group, which it had a jury that looked at your application and your story and how much extra money you sent along to buy your way. And then if you ran it fast enough, though, you could qualify to move up to the other group. And that was always your hope. So and they also limited the number of entries. So they would just cut it off after they had a certain number of letters in their office. And so Dick got us into that by, as soon as he was already one of the runners who had gotten in. So as soon as he got his notice, he would call me, and I would fax to him all of our applications, and there were four or five of us that went over. And then he would immediately go down and put them in the box so that we got our paperwork and everything in at least early enough, and hopefully with our story, we would get in. And we did.
Huh.
And then after, I think, our second year, we all qualified to move up. So we ran it six or seven times over there.
So in 87, you were talking about printing up T-shirts. Was that where you got the idea to print up T-shirts, was from the Dipsy race?
No. That first year in 1982, they had T-shirts.
Oh, okay.
And so I don't know what prompted us or whatever, but everybody said they wanted a T-shirt. So when we started in 1985, I made up T-shirts, and one of the people that I worked with did a picture, and it was very self-serving, people pointed out, because it's a kind of a picture of the canyon in the background, and then a board that says Grand Canyon Shortcut, and then it looks like me crawling out of the canyon. And that's the front of the shirt. And later on in the back of the shirt, we put the profile of the route coming down and back up, and the distances kind of across the bottom.
And did you do that in 87 as well?
Yes, we did that every year up to, I think, even 1996. The guys that took over that year did it that year as well.
Okay.
So I used to have a bunch of those. I did send a couple of those on with that package I sent to
To Kim.
So
yeah.
Yeah.
So in 87, do you have any of the names of the people and their times, roughly?
I do. And if you can hold on.
Yeah.
Can we stop for a minute? Let me go.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
If I can grab that. Okay. Hold on one second. Okay, I'm back.
Great.
And I do have one of my accountings here as well, so if you want to...
Oh, yeah.
I can go through that real quick.
Is that for 87? What's it for? What year?
Let me see. No, it's for 82, so it's a little later.
Okay, well, let's go through it, because it's for 1982. Yeah, what do you got on that? I'm sorry.
1990.
I'm sorry, was that 1990?
1992, I have an accountant.
92. Okay, well, let's wait for that until we get to 92.
Okay.
If that's all right. So we're at 87, and we're talking about who was on that interim and kind of what were a couple of times.
Right. Okay. 1987. Okay. Sorry, I got a stack of paper. I need to go back to you. Okay. 1987 results. So I had 18 people. And the fastest one was Terry Moore at 444 and Dick Lane at 503. And then we had, you want them all?
How about the first five or ten?
Okay. Jerry Carney was next. He was at 522.
Okay.
C.L. Johnson was at 535, as I mentioned. That was his first one. And then Jerry Johnson was 552.
Jerry Johnson.
First five.
Okay. Jerry Johnson lives in Flagstaff, or was he in Phoenix at the time?
He was in Phoenix.
Okay.
Yeah. He was also one of the ones that I had mentioned before that when we were running on the canal, he was the one that mentioned, hey, I did this run the rim to rim. Turned out he ran the same year that I did in 1982, but I did not know him at that time.
Oh, okay. Right.
And then after that, there were two other people that joined our run. Pete Ellard, who was from Phoenix, and a guy by the name of... Tony, I shouldn't have started that. But anyway, Tony Silverman, who was also ran in 1982 and then later joined us in running on this.
Okay. Okay. And so how did that 87 run go?
There were 14 of them that were really there to run, and then there were four of us that at that point in time were walking. Myself, I had a stress fracture and shouldn't have even been there, I guess, according to what I was told. And that I was 729 walking, and we had another guy, Jim Wood, who was 746, and Hal Smith at 922, and then the last guy was Dick Blue, who Denise and I still keep in contact with. He has been back to the canyon not only for this, but I think the last time was like 4 or 5 years ago, and he was 47 and 87, so 40 years later, 35 years later. So he was probably late 70s, early 80s, and he did the rim to rim one more time.
Wow. What was his time in 87?
Pardon?
What was his time in 1987?
Well, he was one of the walkers, so he was never fast.
Right.
Was always steady and very consistent, and his time that year was 10:17, 10 hours and 17 minutes.
Okay, so the people doing it at 5 hours had to kind of chill their feet for 5 hours waiting for the walkers and the slow movers.
Right. Well, we had plenty of beer, and we managed to hang out at the Bright Angel Trailhead. And 1987, 91, and 92, a couple characters, one of them, we had video cameras at the trailhead. And so as they came out, there was always, you know, how'd you do, what was the toughest part, and things like that, and generally just joking around and hanging out. So, and everybody kind of wanted to see everybody else come out.
Cool.
So everybody generally just hung out there, which probably should have got us in trouble, but nobody ever came down and talked to us or anything. We always hung out by where the mule's little compound is.
Corral, the tiny little mule corral there.
Yeah. Yeah. and just hung out there at the trailhead. And like Dick Lane would walk down the trail a half mile and walk up with some people and okay. stuff like that. I mean, it was just everybody kind of wanted to make sure everybody came out and also be there to, you know, rag on them for, you know, how come you're so slow and mm-hmm. how come you didn't run the last 100 yards and things like that.
Hmm. Okay.
And like I said, there were a couple coolers of cold beer at the trailhead, so that helped pass the time as well.
Yeah. But in 87, no sign of the Park Service, no one saying, you know, what are you guys doing?
No one ever bothered us at the right end of the trail.
Okay.
We did have, you know, people come up in backpacks and some other people, they would come over and wonder what was going on. And they'd talk to us and we'd tell them.
Uh-huh.
But nobody from the Park Service ever came over to bother us, which
okay.
at this point in my life surprises me.
87, you know, I'm not sure how popular it was then and how much, you know, I mean, your group is fairly small. Well, in quotes of
yeah.
you know, 20-some people or less, I guess. Yeah, you're right around 20 folks.
Yeah, we're at 18 that year.
Right.
Like,
okay. Yeah. What else do you remember about that 87 run?
Well, we had an international group. We had two guys who were English. They, again, both worked for the company that we worked for.
Okay.
So that's how we knew of them. And they found out about it, and they were runners. I'm trying to think of all the people on there, probably of the 18, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Probably 10 of them were people that were related to us through work, and the other 8 or so were people that I knew from running in Phoenix, or they knew somebody else and brought them along.
Okay. All right. Did you do any other backpacks in the fall or winter of 87?
I did not. CL and I did plan 2 trips, and one of them, he went ahead and did that one. I did not participate in that. He went down and if I remember right, crossed the river again he got down to the river off of Grandview, and I'm not sure how he did that or whatever, but anyway, he crossed.
Yep.
The river and went over to the asbestos mine.
Uh-huh.
And then worked his way back to, was it Crystal? Or not Crystal, the waterfall springs along that side before getting back to Phantom Ranch.
Is that Chiava? Chiava Falls?
Chiava. But there's another one in there too, isn't there?
You think of Clear Creek?
Clear Creek.
The waterfall down low.
Yeah.
Oh, so let me think about this. He could have, if he came down the Miner's Trail below Grandview down to the river
right.
and crossed there, he would have gone up Asbestos.
Yeah.
No, it's not Asbestos. What is it? Vishnu Creek there. And then gotten up on...
Vishnu Creek, but he did go over to Asbestos.
Okay.
And then he worked his way back to Clear Creek.
On the Tonto back, there, sure.
Yeah. And then back to Phantom Ranch, and then back out.
All the while packing the pack raft.
All the while. All the time taking the raft with him.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Huh. Well, you missed out on a good one, that one. That would have been a good one.
Yeah, that was a fall trip, but I really... many times since then, I've regretted that I missed that trip. It just wasn't a good time in my personal life to be doing that one. And then the other one we started to do, was in the spring. And we thought, well, we'd do this and we'd get down in there and into Hindu amphitheater.
Oh, okay.
Down in that area. And we got stuck in snow twice driving out to where we were going to try and drop off.
Okay.
And then it snowed on us once we got out there.
Oy.
So we fumbled around out there for 3 or 4 days and finally decided to heck with it, and we drove back. So
okay.
We really didn't get anything out of that. But that was in a May time frame.
Okay.
Off the North Rim.
All right. So then what happened in 1988? Taking it year by year.
This one was, again, 4-8, so that'd be April 8th to the 14th, with CL. This one was, I got to give a little description at the beginning. CL and I had planned this trip, and he had a friend in Denver who was, CL knew was in great shape, no problem. He was going to meet us at Jacob Lake. And we were going to head down Indian Hollow.
Okay.
And the guy in Denver said, hey, I got this buddy who wants to go along. And DL and I both thought, you know, this guy's in good shape. And he vouched for him, sure. So we met him at Jacob Lake. They drove down from Denver, and we drove up from Phoenix. And we had rooms there at Jacob Lake for that first day. And we got there, and CL and I both looked at each other, and we were really surprised because this fourth person, you could see, was not in real good shape. He was pretty heavy. All of his gear was brand new, brand new backpack. He had a big camera with several lenses and all kinds of stuff. And we were really concerned, and we should have been, but we took him anyway. And we went down Indian Hollow to jump up to Kanab. And then up to Colorado to Deer Creek, up to Thunder, up to the valley.
Surprise!
Where you drop over the Thunder.
Surprise Valley.
Surprise Valley, and then on up that way and back out to Indian Hollow.
Okay.
And
nice loop.
On the way down, there's some sporty sections in there, but we made it down without any problem. And this guy, you could tell quickly, was starting to get concerned, and when he finally got to the Colorado River, and that was after a couple days, he just kind of dropped on the beach and said, you know, I don't know if I'll ever make it out of here, you know, let my family know where I'm at, or something like that. And he was pretty well wiped out. So we started carrying him and his pack and his gear and traded off between the three of us, and we got him to Deer Creek. And then when we got up to Surprise Valley there, we had a big storm come in, and so we stopped early and tended there, and rained and thunder and lightning all night long.
Wow.
And so none of us got much sleep, and we got up the next morning, and again, CL and I put his pack and all of his gear on a pole between the two of us, and then we got it out to back up to Indian Hollow. And the guy never came back again, of course, but he was... We probably never should have even agreed to take him down there because he probably something could have seriously happened to him.
Yeah.
And, you know.
But how do you know that? I mean, you know, a friend of a friend, the friend's vouches for him. He's like, well, yeah, I'd like to go, guys. And, you know, so, you know, you live and learn.
Yeah. I agree with you. And, you know, when CL was leading the first two trips, I met with him, for the junior college, I mean, they made people go to what's now called Piestewa Peak in Tucson or in Phoenix, and with their full pack, and they would go through their pack, and then they'd make them hike up there and back down before they would say they would take them on the trips. So they had some major calibrating. And now, if we'd calibrated this person that way, he never would have gone on the trip.
Right. Right.
Because, I mean, it ended up for two-thirds of it. Three people were carrying his gear the rest of the way.
Yeah. So let's run this itinerary again, me again. So you're at Indian Hollow, and you went down to Jump Up.
Yep.
And then from Jump Up to Kanab to the river.
Yep.
Up along the river, which is kind of a bouldery deal, and you know, it's...
You're right.
No trail there.
It was real bouldery working up there. There's no trail or anything.
And it isn't until you get to Deer Creek that you get into a trail again. And that's nice because there's water there and shade and all that kind of stuff. And then a river runner's coming and going. It might give you a beer. But then from there, you've got to go over to Surprise Valley, up through the Red Wall. And then you've got to walk for miles and miles and miles and miles all the way around to where the trail finally ascends back up to the parking lot up there.
Yeah, there's a big contour that you have to go across for quite a ways before you get back up in the Indian Hollow.
At least there's a trail there.
There is a trail.
So that's something. But still, yeah, that's a pretty big chunk to chew on there for your friend from Denver.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was in April, so there might have been some flowers. It might have been kind of green.
You know, it was a nice trip. I mean, the first part when we were working our way over to Jump Up and stuff like that, there's an old cabin out that way, and we followed a couple roads that we worked our way down, and then even dropping down, I mean, it was kind of like a no-return drop. Several places we dropped down, and yet you were going to have to come out of there some other way.
Okay.
But, there were a lot of deadfall and stuff in that narrow part of that canyon. So I don't know if it had been from winter runoff or whatever, but we were able to scramble down through there.
Okay.
Not easily, but we got down there. And we got to Kanab Creek, and we were coming down, and we came across this group of four guys, and they were laying in the mud in part of the area where there was water in there. And it was really strange. I'm not sure yet what that was all about. But then on past there, we camped, and then we went up, and I knew about this little side canyon from a river trip that went up, and there was a little spring came down, a little pool of water, not too far up the river, up Kanab from the river.
Right. Whispering Falls.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, we spent a day or two then at the river because this guy just had to recover. He was pretty beat up at that point.
Okay.
And so Cielo and I went out and did a little hiking around, just checking stuff out.
Yeah, it's a nice place to kind of base camp out of for a day. But then you have to leave. So, and that journey.
And then we had to go up river.
Yeah.
And bounce along on the rocks. And it was a real stumble up through there to get up to Deer Creek.
Yeah.
And then, of course, getting him up through Deer Creek and the little narrow part in there. Was,
oh, no. Right.
He was, he was pretty nervous going through that area. And so we just kind of, don't look down. Look at where we're going. Look straight ahead.
Yep.
Keep your eyes on me. Don't bother. And we got him through there. And I remember we got in just on the other side where there's people camped right on beyond that. And there were some people camping there. And I don't remember if it was the crows or the mice. But anyway, their camp had been torn up by critters that had gotten in there. Nobody had told them, I guess, or they didn't realize how bad it was in that area.
Okay.
But the critters really torn up their stuff. And we passed them up, and that's when we got up into the Surprise Valley, and the storm hit us up there.
Okay.
Pretty hard that day. Into that night, all night. So.
All right. Well, that sounds like a bit of a challenge.
It was. But, at that time, with all the running and everything we were doing, we were both in probably the best shape we could have been
nice.
At that time. I was in my early 40s, and CL was 55, 56, and he was always strong. Not a big guy, but a strong guy.
Okay. And what else did you do that year?
Well, then the only other thing we did that year was 1988. We did another rim to rim.
When was that?
And let me see if I can find the date. Thank you. This time I was asking $150, and we were October 1st, 1988.
Okay.
And I'm trying to see if I got the 9 or 8 week results. Don't have results for the year. I do have them, but I don't have them on. Sometimes I attach them back, and then I had a spreadsheet I kept. So,
how many people were on the 88 run?
Okay. There were 21 runners.
Wow. Okay. Just like last year, basically.
Yeah.
That and was, were they all runners, or were there any walkers?
Well, we had one who went along. He didn't go across, but he did go with the bus driver back around. We did a couple times. We had a couple people that just wanted to go along for the ride. They didn't want to get involved in trying to do the crossing.
Okay.
But they were interested in going along and just enjoying the camaraderie or whatever you want to call it.
And the aspens in October must have been pretty up there.
Oh, yeah. You know, we lucked out. We never had a bad weather day when we dropped off the North Rim.
Nice.
They were always beautiful. They were cool. You know, it'd be down in the 40s or somewhere around there when we dropped off the rim, but it was always a perfect day. And I know I've done volunteer trips up there in September and had, you know, 15 volunteers, and it was snowing on us. So
right.
The fact that we never got snowed on in October, I was always amazed.
Nice. Okay,
and
so
that year was Dick Blue again, but he was 9 hours and 40 minutes, so he improved almost by an hour.
And he was the slowest.
Yep.
Okay, and what was your time?
That was 1988, right?
Yep.
We're talking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
.644. Ooh,
so
not bad.
I like getting better.
I was going to say that little problem you had with your bones there the year before was all pretty much healed up.
Yep. Well, I did even better the next year. I had my best year that next year.
Okay.
1989.
So. All right, and again, you're organizing this. You got one bus.
Yep.
And you've got the rooms, and you've got the T-shirts to try to recoup some of your funds, but you're charging people $150. So, okay. And so your budget's running around, what, $3,000 here? I'm looking at the math.
Yeah. Let's see if I, real quick, I'll tell you, the total, let me see, 92. I had total cost of $5,000.
In 92. Yeah, that was a bigger group.
People on that one.
Yeah. Do you have your 88 figures?
I do not.
Okay. And was CL on that 82 run?
Yeah, he continued to run then after that every year.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was 88. No, he did not run that year. He ran the next year, then 89.
Okay. And you mentioned Alan Cureton. Did he run? Did he just run in 82, or did he run in later years?
That run was the one that was sponsored by the Pro Advantage people, and I'm sure he kept running. I mean, the last thing I knew, like 5 years ago, he was still running Pikes Peak Marathon.
Okay,
and he was. Maybe it was long ago. Maybe it was 10 years ago, because he was in his early 70s, and he's about 10 years older than I am. So he was still running the Pikes Peak Marathon. I don't know right now if he's still running or how much he's running, but he never was part of our group after that.
Okay.
We just happened to be, Brian and I just happened to luck out and be on a trip where he was there. He was on the bus with us and, you know, talked, you know, he was, that time, you know, he was in late 40s, and very nice person.
Okay.
So I did hear him talk at one of the Grand Canyon symposiums.
Huh.
I think that was the first or the second one.
Okay. So 88, anything else you remember about that run that comes to mind?
No, nothing in particular.
Okay. Charlie, we've been going a little over 50 minutes here. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this. And 89 is the next run. Is that right?
Right. And it's also the next, I had another backpacking trip to Seal in 89.
Okay.
And that was the last one we did until in the 2000s. After, I don't know if you, but anyway, 89. And then after that, we started doing running on the Arizona Trail and some other places. So
okay.
We kind of dropped off on our backpacking and we were doing a lot more longer runs, a lot more trail running and stuff like that. So we kind of shifted away from the canyon at that point.
Okay. All right.
We still trimmed the rims, but we didn't do any more backpacking until 2000. Let me see. Uh, 2001 was
okay.
The last backpacking with CL.
Hmm.
So we went from 1989.
All right. Is there anything else you want to add into the material that we've covered?
At this point, no. I think we're pretty much up to date at 1989. We haven't talked about that yet, so we'll talk about that, I assume, the next time. So
yeah.
We'll start there.
Okay,
yeah.
That sounds good.
Great.
Well, with that, let's conclude part 7 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Charlie Schultz. Today is Friday, April 7th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Charlie, thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.